Well, have those black flies been bugging you? Well, the good news is their reign of terror is almost over. I'm Jill Nadeau, in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you with us on the Ideas Network. PJ Leish is back with us. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and holds degrees in biological sciences and entomology. He'll talk about those nasty little black flies and tell us about a cool bug-related festival. And he'll take your bug-related questions. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And of course, you can always send us an email, too, with pictures, if you have them, to ideas@wpr.org. Hey, PJ.
Good to be here.
Good to see you again. So let's get this cleared up. What is the official name of those tiny little biting bugs?
Well, this year in particular, I've gotten a lot of questions about simply little flies.
Little flies,
yes. Flying around your head, that sort of thing. And when I think of small flies, the word gnat comes to mind.
Right.
And the word gnat, though, can be a very broad general term. And we refer to small true flies as gnats. But sometimes if it's a small flying insect, someone may simply call it a gnat and they might not know exactly what group it's from. But one type of gnat or small fly I've seen lots of this year are black flies.
Okay.
And these are true flies. They've only got two wings on their body, from a specific family, the family Simuliidae. And what stands out about these is they are blood feeders. So they're kind of like mosquitoes in that regard, but they're very, very small in a lot of cases. A lot of the common species I've seen this year are about a tenth of an inch long, whereas mosquitoes are several times that
size.
Huge
in comparison, right?
Exactly, yeah. They have, in some regards, life cycles similar to mosquitoes. It's the females that are coming to get a blood meal. They need that nutrition to be able to lay their batch of eggs. The nice thing about black flies, though, is they're typically active for a pretty short period of time. What complicates that a little bit is we have about 30 different species in Wisconsin. So when you get a black fly species active as adults, that individual species might be active for 2 to 4-ish weeks, and then they kind of quiet down for a year. But if you have one species just quieting down as another species is coming out, it can seem like they're never ending, but it's actually overlapping different species.
Yeah.
Typically, though, I see black flies late spring and early summer. June is probably the peak month that I see. And we do notice over time fluctuations. Some years are just bad black fly years like this year.
Yeah.
Probably has something to do with the weather patterns over the last 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
Black flies themselves, they develop in actually some really clean water. They like kind of cooler water, clean, lots of dissolved oxygen. That's pretty much trout streams when you think about it. They're not going to be in really heavily polluted streams and things like that. So to a certain extent, they might be a general indicator of good water quality. But when they come out, sometimes they can fly or get blown long distances, and they can really be a major pest for a period of several weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They'll bite humans. Out of the 30 species in our area, we have about 5 or 6 that will bite humans. We have some other species that won't bite you, but they'll hang out around your face. They may kind of get in your eyes, around mm-hmm. your nose and mouth. They're not necessarily biting, but they're still a major nuisance in
yes.
that regard. So lately, I haven't really been getting bitten myself, but I have some of those nuisance species around. These other species would really much rather feed on mammals. Some species go after birds as well. And we can have some major issues with these sometimes in agricultural settings. I mean, you can get lots of these that will feed on livestock, for example. And there's cases documented in the literature where livestock can actually die because of
yeah.
these if they're
mm-hmm.
that bad. If you've heard of black flies, you might have heard of them in association with like the Boundary Waters canoe area up in northern Minnesota and lakes up in Canada. They can be really bad up there. This year just seems to be a really good year for them. They're quieting down, it seems, but the month of June, I had lots and lots of reports of them.
Right. Okay, well, we've got lots and lots of calls and emails, so let's go straight to them.
Sure.
Our first one, we've got Jennifer, and she's in Verona. Hi, Jennifer.
Good morning. Thanks so much for taking my call. Like lots of people around in this area, I am a backyard chicken person. I've got 7 birds that I share in a coop with a neighbor. And we've had issues with, I don't know if they're gnats, I don't know if they're noceans, but little swarming flying insects that are bothering my chickens. And somebody had told me that apparently if they swarm, they can actually kill the chicken. And I don't know the mechanism by which they do that, if they fly into their nostrils or whatever. So I was wondering if you had any tips of anything that I could use around to try and dissuade some of these critters. We feed all organic and whatever, so we'd prefer not to use any real pesticides.
Okay. Well, a couple of thoughts, and I have heard of poultry deaths caused by black flies, and two things could potentially go on. If you have enough swarming around the head, they can actually get into the nose and things like that and end up causing suffocation, essentially. There are other cases, and this is more rare, where you just get so many of them that when they are feeding on blood, actual due to blood loss.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty rare, but it can happen if they're high. So if these are indeed black flies, which I have a suspicion they could be, not going to be a whole lot that we can do at this point. As I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, the source where the larvae and pupae develop is really trout streams and rivers and things like that. And that could be some distance from you. It could be 5, 10 or more miles down the road. And we're not going to go in and put some, you know, pesticides in the river to get at the source directly. So that doesn't really work. In terms of repellents on chickens and things like that, you know, I don't know of anything quite registered for that. I have had some conversations with farmers this year with livestock, and often with these black flies, we know the behavior for many species. They tend to be more active later in the day, so like late afternoon and early evening. So I wonder if you could try potentially letting the chickens out at different times of the day. Maybe if you kept them in an enclosed area with like some mesh screening in late afternoon and evening, that might cut down on the number getting to them. And if you had them out, you know, wandering around earlier in the day, maybe they wouldn't get as many bites. If they are indeed black flies, things should kind of run their course and quiet down. One other thing you could potentially try, because black flies, they're really small. If there's going to be a decent wind, they're going to have a hard time physically maneuvering in that because of the forces involved. And so you could potentially try rigging up a big, strong fan, getting some air movement around the chickens and see if that might be a way to help them. And that would be an entirely non-chemical way to go about it, too. So just something to try.
Yeah, that's a great suggestion about the fan. I know it works for mosquitoes, too.
Yeah.
I've used that before. So well, good luck, Jennifer. I hope your little chickens are fine. Next, Anna in Superior has a question for you. Hi, Anna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The fan is a good idea, too. But I find that the flies still manage to bite me, and they love my legs, my ankles. And I do wear socks, but they seem to get through my socks. I have to wear compression socks, so they seem to get through those. Is there anything natural I can use? Because I'm allergic to the over-the-counter stuff that you normally buy for a repellent.
Like DEET?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, when it comes to flies, there are differences. So knowing the exact type of fly would be helpful. Now, in this case, given your location up near Lake Superior and the fact you mentioned that these flies are biting lower legs and ankles, I wonder if you might be dealing with an insect we call stable flies, which are really an agricultural pest. They will go to livestock. The larvae breed in manure of livestock, but when the adults come out, they can sometimes fly very long distances, 20, 50 miles, or get blown long distances. I've had several occasions where I've been up camping or at a cabin on the shores of Lake Superior, and these flies show up in force, and to a certain extent, it can just be kind of bad luck. You're right, the repellents often aren't a magic solution. They just don't work very well compared to, you know, mosquitoes. Repellents generally work pretty well against those. Some of the larger biting flies, they have very strong visual cues that they use that they're coming in to find you with, and some of the repellents just don't do as good of a job with those. So you mentioned your concerns with DEET, with the allergy or something along those lines. I will mention there are a couple other commercial repellents you could try. There are some that contain picaridin. There is one that has science behind it, contains oil of lemon eucalyptus. And this is a, you know, specific repellent. And the thing about these repellent ingredients I mentioned, these are EPA registered ones, meaning that there have been experiments showing they actually work. There's a lot of recipes online for, you know, use a couple drops of this essential oil on that one, and it smells lovely. Those usually either don't work, or if they do have repellent properties, it tends to be very, very short-lived. Back in early June, I was at a cookout, used one of these natural-type products. It smelled wonderful, had vanilla in it, and after spritzing it on myself, within 5 seconds, I had a mosquito land on me. So again, those some of those natural concoctions that you might see on the internet or Facebook, there's not the science behind them compared to the EPA-registered repellents. If you try those and still don't like those, one of the best options is long sleeves.
Right.
If it's cool enough, especially if you're on the shore of Lake Superior and there's a decent breeze, that might be an option. I've even seen where, and we know we can get mosquito head nets out there, you can actually buy a mesh suit, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that is a physical barrier, so that it may be harder for them to actually get to your ankles. I've also seen folks, if you're reading on the shore of Lake Superior, just draping a big beach towel over your legs so they physically can't get to
through
you.
It. And the other thing, Anna said that she, it's her ankles mostly, and she wears compression socks. And Anna, you might want to think about putting regular cotton socks over those, and that would be another barrier.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, good luck, Anna. Thank you so much for calling. Woo, do you have a question about insects? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. And you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Next, we'll go to Linda, and she's in southeast Wisconsin. Hi, Linda.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
I've lived on a lake in southeast Wisconsin for 30 years, and this is the first year people are complaining. We think we have swimmer's itch or whatever. I'm not even sure if that's a bug, but I'm wondering what information he has on that, how long it will last, or once you have it, do we always have it? Or, that's my question.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's a good question, and I know a little bit about swimmer's itch, but not a whole lot. It's not an insect, so it's not anything in the water, swimming around, insect-like that's biting you. Swimmer's itch is actually a parasite of birds, and what can happen is if you are in water that has this swimmer's itch parasite there, the parasites try to use you as a host. We're basically a dead end. They get under the skin. They essentially die there. That causes a reaction of your body, and so you get pretty itchy. Everyone reacts kind of differently. Some folks might not react at all. Other folks might get large welts. I remember when I was younger, I think bumping into it once or twice and getting a lot of red itchy bumps all over the place. In terms of what to do about it, I'm not really aware of anything great that you'll be able to do to solve it. It might be something that has to run its course. I wonder if you were to chat with my colleague, David Drake, our wildlife extension specialist, he may know a bit more about it in terms of if there's anything that you can do, but I just don't know of anything mm-hmm. off the top of my head.
Yeah, and that's one of those, even a dermatologist maybe might be able to help you, or some over-the-counter itch relief. I don't know. If anybody has an idea, let us know. And speaking of an idea, let's go to Jill in Rice. Hi, Jill.
Hi, I'm from Rice Lake.
Rice Lake. I thought that was probably the case. Go ahead.
Yes, and I don't know if this works. I just want 2 seconds to pass it along.
Sure.
For the lady, try Vicks VapoRub to repel biting flies. I just read it someplace. Maybe it works.
Okay.
I know how they are. Okay?
All right. Thanks, Jill. I've heard that one, too. Have you tried it?
I've heard it. I haven't tried it personally. I wouldn't expect that to really help a whole lot, or if it did, probably not a very long-lived repellency.
Yeah, I would agree with you. Not that I'm an expert, but and let's go to some emails now. We've got an email from Maureen. She's in Viroqua. She emailed a photo of a black bug with wings. It has a big gold dot below its head and some smaller white dots on the side of its body. Do you know what that is, PJ?
Yeah, so this is a type of fly, name off the top of my head, I think family Regionidae, goldenback snipe fly is a common name for this one. I see lots of them in June and parts of July, very common near vegetation. So if you're out hiking in the woods, you got a lot of plants in your yard, insects like that can be surprisingly common. But with that coloration, I mean, it's really a beautiful insect to have that
a
dense golden patch mm-hmm. of hairs or seedy on the thorax. So it's just a cool insect to look
really
at.
And really solid black, too. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I am Jill Nadeau, and Dave Potras is our technical director today, and Jane Rotunda is our on-air producer.
We are talking to entomologist P.J. Leach about insects today. What questions do you have for him? You can give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. The lines are full right now, so keep trying. Or you can send us an email, and that is ideas@wpr.org. And let's go back to email. We got another picture. This one was from Christy in Fort Atkinson, and she found a bug on her patio door, and she needs some help identifying it. This year, she's been finding a lot of earwigs in her home also. What can she do naturally to keep them out? So,
all right. So first, the insect in the picture, this is a juvenile stage, or what we call a nymph of a stink bug.
I'd
have to compare some of my pictures to tell you the exact species. I'm almost wondering if it's from the predatory stink bug group within that family, but we've got dozens of different stink bug species in our area. In terms of earwigs, it doesn't surprise me to hear about decent numbers of earwigs this year because they thrive under damp conditions, which we've had an awful lot of rain this year, as well as last year as well. So perhaps a couple years in a row, you know, could lead to their numbers building up. If you're looking for more of a natural or chemical-free way to keep those out of your home, the absolute best thing you can do is what I'd call physical exclusion, and that involves essentially sealing up entrance points so that they can't get into your house in the first place. So that may be going around the foundation with caulk gun, insulating, expanding foam that you get in a spray can, things like that, steel wool or something to shove in cracks and physically seal it up. That might be things like double-checking all the window and door screens, weather stripping around windows and doors, stuff like that. If everything's sealed up nice and snug, they're not going to be able to get in the first place, and then you won't have to spray anything in theory. Now, if you look at most houses, even if it's brand new, I mean, you just can't seal everything up. But that physical exclusion is a chemical-free way that can be a really big step to keeping outside all kinds of insects, earwigs, ants, and lots of other things, too.
Right, and helps with energy costs, too. So double duty. All right, let's go back to the phones, and we have Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Yes, I was wondering if the deer tick, the lime tick, is native to Norway, Scotland, and northern England?
Yes, that's a good question. I'd have to double check, but off the top of my head, I don't think they have the same deer tick that we do, which is Ixodes scapularis. However, they do have very closely related ticks over there that visually, to naked eye, if you had it side by side with our deer tick, you wouldn't really be able to tell them apart. So they're very, very closely related, same genus, Ixodes, but it's essentially a European species. And I do recall several years ago, my wife and I were on a trip to Scotland, hiking through Glen Etive, this very picturesque valley in the Highlands, and walking through a grassy area, and sure enough, found one of these European versions of the deer tick. So they do have some essentially deer ticks, that same group, but as far as I know, it's a different species than the ones that we have here.
Do they have a problem with Lyme there?
They do have some medical concerns that I've heard about over there. I'm not very much in tune with how much or how big the concern is over there compared to us here. But anytime you have ticks present, there may be some disease concerns involved.
Sure. Great. Thanks for the question, Mary. Next, we have Rick, and he's up in northern Wisconsin somewhere. What's your question, Nick? Rick?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I heard you talking about black flies, and we have an overabundance of deer flies. Is that the same fly?
Those are not the same fly. Black flies, true black flies, are really pretty small, about a tenth of an inch, or certainly under a quarter of an inch in the vast majority of cases. Deer flies are from a different family, family Tabanidae. They're close relatives of horse flies. And although there may be some species of deer flies that have black on the body, they're not true black flies. So they are definitely different.
And they really bite.
Those do. You know, I've been up in the North Woods and had deer flies really pursue me quite a ways. Deer flies and other close relatives like horse flies, they rely very heavily on visual cues. And it makes sense over evolutionary time. They have cued in to follow dark-colored moving objects because that may be a deer or a bear or something for them to feed on. And so if you have on a dark-colored shirt, you're out on a run through the woods or biking or something like that, you know, they might not get you while you're moving, but as soon as you stop, Like, they're right there again right away, and they can pursue you quite a ways.
I used to ride horses in the woods, and oh my gosh, yeah. Nasty things. All right, well, thanks for the question, Rick. Let's go to Judith, and she's in Muskego. Hi, Judith.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a comment and a question. I have done very, very well with Skin So Soft from Avon to Biting Touch. But my question is turf grass millipedes. There's hundreds of them on the outside of our house at the foundation. How can I get rid of them? My husband's ready to get the napalm, you know, but I was hoping for something more organic.
Good idea.
All right. So first, while it's fresh in my mind, the Avon Skin So Soft, there's actually some truth behind that. There is an ingredient in that that we don't have a great common name for, but IR3535, that actually has repellent properties, and it is considered an EPA-registered repellent. So there's some truth behind that, even though it's used, you know, for other reasons as well. In terms of the millipedes, in the last 2 weeks, I have just gotten a flood of calls and emails about millipedes. In short, millipedes are kind of similar to earwigs in that they thrive under damp conditions, which we've had this year. We've had really the last several years in a row. So it's been some really good conditions for millipedes. Millipedes can travel long distances, especially at night. They don't like to be out during the day if it's bright and sunny, hot and dry, things like that. They like cooler, damper conditions. So probably active at night. And millipedes themselves feed on decaying plant material. So fallen leaves. If I wanted to find millipedes, I'd go look at a compost pile, rotting logs. If I had a yard that butted up to a wooded area or a prairie area or something like that, that's some prime millipede habitat. If you have a situation like that where you know they may be coming from certain habitat, you could go out after dark with a flashlight and check and see, are they moving from the wood lot or a prairie area? If that's the case, you might be able to use a turf grass insecticide, just a band or strip at the edge of the yard where the lawn meets the habitat where the millipedes are coming from, and try and stop them in their tracks there before they get up to their house. Unfortunately, though, out of all the pests I deal with, millipedes can perhaps be one of the most frustrating ones, because you can spray for them and you can kill millipedes and more just keep coming. I have seen cases where you can get millipedes piling up along a foundation, you know, several inches deep.
Oh, my.
And so if you have some that you spray your foundation and the first batch dies, well, more walking across those and still getting to the side of your house. So they can be very, very frustrating. Often, though, some good news, I do tend to see seasonal patterns. So often a spring, especially late spring, early summer, is kind of a peak season, in my opinion, for millipedes. I often see sometimes some activity in the fall, too, a little bit quieter during midsummer, you know, August or something like that. So things may quiet down on their own over the course of time. Another helpful thing to look at, when you look at your overall yard, look and think about places that might be potential millipede habitat. If you've got a lot of mulch beds, dense plant beds with ferns and hostas, stuff that holds in the moisture, that could be good millipede habitat. And so one thing that might be helpful if you have plants right against the side of your house, maybe create a gap of a couple feet between your home and the plants. Get some more airflow, dry things out a little bit. That might be helpful, and maybe thinning out the overall vegetation. That may help. Otherwise, if your lawn has a lot of thatch accumulation, that's the layer between the actual blades of grass and the soil where all the clippings accumulate. If you have a buildup of a lot of thatch, that decaying organic matter, that might be food for millipedes, so maybe you could consider doing something about that. We do have conventional sprays for these, but again, you can spray the side of your house. The thought is to keep them from getting in, but more tend to keep coming because you can sometimes bump into really, really high numbers, and so there isn't a magical solution for these. You kind of have to wait it out and let things run their course.
Okay. Well, thank you for that question, Judith. Ross in Middleton emailed, and he's wondering, with all the rain this year, the mosquito numbers don't seem to be that bad in Middleton. And any ideas why?
So that's a good question. I'm in Middleton as well. And, you know, I can go out on my back deck when it's not too hot and eat dinner and just have a mosquito or two. In general, we know mosquitoes need water. So, you know, intuitively, you would think if we have a very rainy year, it should be good conditions for mosquitoes. And that's what we saw last year in 2018, June of 2018, just astronomical numbers of mosquitoes. What I almost wonder might have happened this year, because we had very regular, somewhat heavy rains every couple of days there for a while. What could happen is if you had some eggs hatch and you have those mosquito larvae developing, maybe some pupae in there too, if a heavy rainfall comes along and kind of flushes those out from the puddle they're developing in and they end up kind of high and dry on the ground, that's going to be the end of the line for them. Mm-hmm. They're not going to be able to make it to the adult stage. They need to be in water. So I almost wonder if this year that scenario might have been playing out where we got so much rain regularly that it was just kind of flushing them away and kind of broke up that life cycle. So that's kind of my working theory at this point.
I like that theory. I think that's you got something there because really it's the truth. They need still water, correct?
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. They're not a fan of moving water. So mm-hmm. if you're a trout stream with rapids and riffles, that's not great mosquito habitat. It's might be a standing puddle to the side of the river stream sure. or other areas like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, let's go to Sally. She's in Sparta. Hi, Sally.
Yes, hi. I have a comment about the keeping bugs off of chickens.
Okay.
And I use diatomaceous earth. You can get it at the farm store or any garden center. And I put it where in their nest underneath the bedding, and I put it in the where the chickens dust. And I even put it, when I had donkeys, I used to put it on their backs, and it kept away a large amount of bugs.
Okay.
It's real light. It's like talcum powder. Well, more like cornstarch. It's very, very light.
Mm-hmm.
But it really does help.
Okay.
And it's relatively cheap. You can get a large bag for maybe $10. And it's very light, and you could put it on your cereal, and it wouldn't hurt you. I mean, it does. You don't want to, but it's not going to hurt anything. It's organic, and that's my comment.
Okay, thank you, Sally. Have you heard that before, PJ?
Well, so there are products out there that contain diatomaceous earth, and we can use them for insect control. The thing is, if you hop online, there's different types of diatomaceous earth. There are some that are specifically formulated with pretty much very specific particle size that work much better against killing insects. And we can use diatomaceous earth to kill certain insects in certain situations. Indoors, we use it for bed bugs, for example, in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't really expect it to work great as a repellent, though. It might be used for other things, dust baths with birds, for example, for controlling mites or something like that. But I haven't heard or seen any research on it repelling flies. So you could always find or look for a product approved for use on poultry and try it out and see if it works. But as I said, I just haven't seen any research showing that would be a really good fly repellent for chickens.
Could it be that they're dying because of the diatomaceous earth before they can bother them?
Well, my impression, it doesn't work that quickly.
Okay.
Basically, how the diatomaceous earth works, insects are covered with this waxy coating on their exoskeleton.
Mm-hmm.
It disrupts that so that they lose moisture to the environment. They dry out and die, essentially.
Okay.
And that's not a snap your fingers and they're dead type scenario. It does take a while. So that's why I wouldn't expect it to work very well as a repellent.
Okay. Steve emailed asking, is there a resource that lists which insects live on which Wisconsin native plants? The prairie garden in his yard has some very interesting insects on the native plants. And how do these bugs sense and find those plants?
Ah, so I'm not aware of a single list or webpage that would have that information. That information is out there, but it's often scattered here and there. I do have a couple books in my office. They're by the same author, which I can't think of off the top of my head. But there's one that's called something along the lines of the Book of Field and Roadside, the Book of Swamp and Bog, and I think he may have one that has prairie plants or pasture plants, things like that. And so that might be something to look into from your local library. And if you can find those, it basically has a series of very small chapters that are about 2-3 pages long. It lists a certain plant, and it lists all the other creatures associated with it. So it'll list diseases and fungi and things like that. It lists insects. If there's a certain bird that likes a given plant, it'll list that too.
Hmm.
So that's often a type of book. I pull those out from time to time. If I know an insect is on a certain plant that I know, but I don't know what the insect is, I kind of work backwards and use that book to figure out. So there are some resources out there. Otherwise, just some detective work online might be a good way to go about it. But again, I don't know of a single specific webpage or resource that just lists all those plants and the insects found on them.
All right. So, Steve, head for your library. And speaking of plants with wanting to know what is causing problems, we have Bill in Manitowoc with a question. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Great show today. My roommate in college majored in entomology, so it's good to talk to you. But I have milkweed plants growing wild in my backyard, and I noticed that there's holes in them. So I don't know if that's from the butterflies or from insects. Okay. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill.
Sure. So, couple thoughts. I mean, when I think of milkweeds, and probably most folks as well think of monarch caterpillars. So that would be something to go out and look for, check the undersides of leaves. They may be hiding to a certain extent. So monarch caterpillars that turn into those monarch butterflies, that's one possibility. But there's actually a fairly long list of insects that live on and feed on milkweed. So another very common one that I see is kind of black and orange and fuzzy. That's the milkweed tussock moth. Sometimes I will see those in very, very large numbers. That could be another possibility. There are some longhorn beetles that live on milkweed. That could be a possibility. Red and black, about 3/4 of an inch long with some really long antennae. There are some leaf beetles, about 1/2 inch long, very convex, a very vibrant orange and black color on them. That could be a possibility as well. So I think in this case, if you want to know exactly what's nibbling on your milkweed, it would be helpful to go out and do a thorough inspection on the undersides of the leaves, especially, and see what you can find.
Okay. Thanks for that question, Bill. And next is Neil in Milwaukee. Hi, Neil.
Good afternoon. You had a question earlier about swimmer's itch.
Yes.
It's a parasite that lives part of its life in waterfowl or wildlife, and then it infects snails. And then when those snails release the parasite, it goes looking back for its original host, like a duck. Unfortunately, it may find your skin first. It won't infect you, but what it'll do is it'll attempt to burrow into your skin, and then you get that rash. And some people get the rash worse than others. A couple of ideas to try to avoid it is it tends to have a hatch period that's about 2 weeks long, and it tends to happen right now in mid-July. So one is to avoid swimming during those times.
Oh.
another idea, though, is to before it has a chance to burrow into your skin, you can easily wash it off. So taking a shower as soon as you get out of the lake will usually get rid of them before they burrow into your skin. And then there's some anecdotal information that some waterproof sunscreens may actually prevent them from burrowing into your skin.
Well, that makes sense. Well, thank you very much, Neil. We have such smart listeners. Appreciate that. Let's go now to Ted in Madison. Hi, Ted.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk more about using birds to control insects. I noticed in the spring, cleaning off my deck, kind of weird, I noticed cleaning off some of the bird excrement in the spring, there's a lot of millipedes in the bird excrement. So I think they use those as a source of food in the spring. So are there other ways to attract birds to control insects maybe in the spring to keep them away for the summer?
Okay. Yeah, good question. I mean, there are certainly ways to encourage birds, and David Drake or Jamie Nack would be great folks to talk to about that. They'd have much better suggestions than I would. But I mean, in general, things like birdhouses and stuff like that might bring birds into your yard. I just haven't seen any scientific studies, though, that have documented that that would actually have a significant impact on the insect populations in your yard. They may eat some things like millipedes. When I bump into millipede problems, though, I mean, we're not talking thousands of millipedes. We're probably talking on the order of millions or tens of millions. If you have a big yard, you live in a rural area, and millipedes tend to be more active at night, whereas birds more active during the day.
True.
So they might end up eating some, but probably not going to put a major dent in their population. Again, birds, lots of birds feed on insects in general, but if you have, say, an outbreak of a certain insect, even if a large number of them are being eaten, that's a small percentage of the overall population. Mm-hmm. It may not seem like it's making much
of
a dent.
Sure, sure. And Jamie and David will be with us the first Wednesday of August. So if you want to ask them about attracting birds to your area, then call us back, Ted. And Ted, you also had a second question, correct? Ted, are you still there? Okay, I guess we lost Ted. Sorry about that. Next up, we are going to Gail, and she's in Fish Creek. Hi, Gail.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a great product to share that helps with the fly situation. It's usually used on where there's horses because it helps to get rid of the flies from the compost of the manure and everything. But if people have a compost pile in their area, they're going to attract the same kind of flies. And these flies can go for miles. So that woman with the chickens can have a compost pile and not realize she may have these flies. But the Spalding Laboratories actually sells those little bugs that you put out in the yard that eat the larvae of the fly that grow on the top of the soil in the grasses and on the ground. And then you don't, it kind of keeps the fly population down because these little bugs eat the larvae. And Spalding Laboratories makes them. And they also now make a spray for flies, which is all essential oils and things that work. And when we would go horseback riding, we used to use a long time ago Skin So Soft from Avon. And we would take the wipes and wipe them on the horses' faces. And we never had any flies out on the trail or anywhere in the barns or whatever. So that's my suggestions for people that they might want to try. It's worked for us, and so I thought I'd call and share.
Great. Thank you very much, Gail. Appreciate that. I guess you just have to keep trying things until they work.
Yeah. So in terms of like flies associated with a manure pile on a horse farm or dairy farm or something like that, we do get certain flies that live in association with manure, things like house flies and stable flies, for example. If you have a farm with livestock, you're going to have manure. That's just a fact of life.
Yes.
If you have manure, you're going to have flies. That's another fact of life. So you have to do something with that manure, either spread it out so it dries out or compact it or do something so that it's less useful to flies, but you're still probably going to get some flies. And often farmers either have to spray for that in some cases, or as the caller had mentioned, there are what I've heard call fly predators. They're essentially parasites. They're a little tiny wasp, a couple of millimeters long, and they specifically parasitize the pupae of house flies and some of the other flies in manure. And from reports I've had and conversations with folks on things like horse farms, it can work fairly well. Problem is it's a little bit on the pricier side in some cases, and you have to keep doing this throughout the season.
Sure.
To keep them in check. So mm-hmm. There's some truth to that, but against things like black flies that are developing in rivers, it wouldn't work against those.
Right. Okay. Well, we're talking about insects today. Do you have a question or comment? You can give us a call. Lines are full right now, but you can keep trying. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau, filling in for Larry today. On the show tomorrow at 11, we take a look at the B-17 bomber, better known as the Flying Fortress of World War II. And then at 11:45, we'll talk about the 40th year of the American Players Theater. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. Hope you can join us. And of course, right now we are talking about bugs. Yeah, mosquitoes are always top of mind, but we're talking about insects. And we did get an email, PJ, from Dick, and it's a photo of a pretty interesting looking bug. It has yellow legs and antennae, wings that are somewhat transparent, and a very long black needle-like antenna. What is it?
Yeah, so I recognize this creature right away. It's from a group we call the giant ichneumon wasps, and this species is one of the commonest ones in that group that I see. It's Megarissa atreida, which is a species that is mostly black. We have three others in that group that are kind of more of a reddish, brownish, yellow mottled color. And these are perhaps a bit intimidating in size. The actual length of the insect, and I can tell this is a female based on that very long filament at the end of the body. And her length of her body without that filament is about 1.5 to 2 inches long. They look very intimidating, and they are indeed wasps. They can't sting you, though. So it's all bark, no bite in this situation. What they do, though, is these insects go to dead, dying, decaying trees. And their life story is they are specifically looking for other insects already living in that tree. So you have insect larvae tunneling in the tree, like horntails and other things. And the female wasp actually has to uncoil that long filament. It's three pieces that snap together, and she keeps that curled up inside her body. So it's a long, lengthy process. There's membranes that pop out. It's really cool to watch.
Wow.
So she uncoils this thing, and that's essentially a drill or an ovipositor she uses to drill through the wood. It gets even more wild than that. The tip of it is specifically hardened with metal ions. So she's basically got a metal tip drill to drill through the wood, find the other insect living in there. She's going to lay her eggs. Her eggs will then attack and parasitize and kill the other insect. And that's how this giant ichneumon wasp goes through its life cycle, is parasitizing these. So again, they look very intimidating because the length of the body plus the length of that ovipositor might be 8 to 10-ish inches. Mm-hmm. So massive compared to a lot of other insects.
Definitely.
But really, they're completely harmless
to
us.
Leave them alone. That is just fascinating. Speaking about fascinating, you have an event that's coming up soon.
Yes.
You're celebrating insects. So
yes.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we hear a lot of bad stuff in the news these days about insect declines and things like mm-hmm. that. And the UW-Madison Department of Entomology is going to be hosting an event actually late next week. Next week, Friday, July 26th and July 27th. It's a two-day event up at the Kemp Natural Resources Station in Woodruff, Minocqua area. So if you're looking for an excuse to head to the North Woods, this, I think, is a pretty good one. We've got a number of talks lined up, things like how to collect, how to observe insects, our major insect groups. If you've never taken an entomology class and you just want to know what are our common ones that we see out there, we've got a talk on that. We've got some folks that are going to be speaking about medical entomology, a really cool activity related to forensic entomology and how scientists can use insects to solve murders and crimes and things like that. We have activities for kids and folks of all ages, a scavenger hunt for kids and things like that, and lots of other fun things in store. So if you are up in the North Woods or you'd like to know more about it, probably the easiest way to find information is head to the website for Wisconsin Insect Fest. And the easiest way to find that, it's tinyurl.com/Wisconsin Insect Fest. Or if you just Google it, you should be able to find it. It's also on the UW Entomology website and Facebook page. So we've got all these talks and activities going on. We also have going on at the same time a big activity called the Great Wisconsin Bug Hunt. And this is essentially a 24-hour BioBlitz. So we are asking the question, how many insects and other arthropods can we find if we look really hard in the span of 24 hours? So we're going to be out there looking. I'm going to have my nice camera out taking pictures of insects that I see and other cool stuff. On Friday night, on July 26th, we have part of that event registered with National Moth Week, which is starting very soon. And so we are going to be putting out some black lights and also a mercury vapor light, which is really, really bright. And all kinds of moths and cool insects come to those. And so we'll use that as a surveying technique to see what type of insects we can observe. So we've got fun stuff in store like that. And then at about 5 p.m. on Saturday, we'll kind of announce how many different insects we found.
So that is so cool.
Should be a lot of fun.
Yeah, it should definitely be a lot of fun. So, and you'll get to meet PJ. So, all right, well, let's go back to the phones. And we have Jeff in Fox Lake who has a question. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Say, I recently came across something I hadn't seen before. It's a caterpillar that appears to be laying predominantly, it's laying eggs with web-like structure similar to like you would see an apple tree, but they were exclusively doing this on bull thistles or musk thistle. And they really encompassed the whole plant to the point it seemed to choke the plant back. I was get rid of most of them. I left some of them. Now we looked it up and I had found thistle caterpillar, but only through any information was from Kansas State University. I wonder if it's common here or if I don't have the right species.
Okay. So we do have thistle caterpillars, and these are very spiky, spiny-looking caterpillars. They actually turn into a black and orange butterfly called the painted lady butterfly. which can be pretty common. So they are out there. Occasionally, I do bump into them in decent numbers, actually in agricultural fields. They'll sometimes show up in like a soybean field, and the farmer might see, hanging out on a plant, maybe some webbing on there too. And the caterpillars, again, are very spiky. They can either be kind of dark blackish or kind of a pale whitish yellow color as well. So they're actually fairly common in our area. So it doesn't surprise me too much that you bumped into some of those.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that call, Jeff. Next up, we've got Terry. He's up in the UP. Yay! Where he's got a question. Terry, what's your question?
Oh, yeah, well, this year I've had a lot of milkweed growing. I finally got some established well and a bumper crop of monarch caterpillars, which is great. So many that they just devastated my plants until there's hardly anything left of them.
Wow.
I had three or four of those large ones on one plant, you know. But that was a week or so ago, those large ones started to move off to go somewhere to pupate. Now, I don't know where they go in the wild to do it. I used to see them in, where I used to live. They'd climb on a brick wall. But in the wild, where there aren't human things to climb on, what do they seek? Where are they trying to go? They want protection from the weather, I'm sure, and predators. I followed one yesterday for 2.5 hours through the tall grass, and I finally had to give up.
Oh,
I don't know where he was going. What are they looking for? What are they trying to find?
Well, I'd say in general, they're probably looking for a somewhat protected spot. I see them very commonly on undersides of leaves and things like that. I will see them sometimes right on the milkweed plants themselves. I've also seen them on other nearby vegetation, or if there is a building or other structure nearby, sometimes on features of the building as well. So in your situation, why that one was wandering for a couple hours, that's got me scratching my head. That's a test of patience to follow it that long.
I guess. So maybe Terry was bothering it.
But ultimately, I think they're probably seeking out some type of shelter. Altered spot, again, undersides of leaves is probably one of the commonest places that I find where they produce their chrysalis stage.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks for that interesting question, Terry. George is next, and he's in Verona. Hi, George.
Hi. I just want to call in. I'm a retired analyst from the state's Public Environmental Health Lab, and the person that commented on using diatomaceous earth, it's great that it doesn't have pesticides, but be cautious. You should not breathe that dust. That's the silica dust, and that can cause long-term permanent lung damage. So just be cautious. Treat it like any other dust that is hazardous. So that's all I wanted to pass on. Just be cautious.
Okay, and George,
just because it doesn't have pesticides, it doesn't mean it's not harmful.
Right, good point. And George, are there different kinds of diatomaceous earth?
As your guest mentioned, there's different sieve size or particle size. And to be honest with you, I can't tell you which one's the most hazardous. Typically, the ones that are lighter that can be breathed into the lungs tend to be the ones that cause the most problems. But again, that's not my area of expertise.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, George. Appreciate you sharing that with us.
Yeah, and I guess just a follow-up on that. I mean, that is a very good point. And we do certainly have diatomaceous earth we can use that's registered as a pesticide. Even though if a pesticide is organic, it doesn't mean there's no risks associated with it. You always have at least some types of risks. Some may be relatively safe products compared to others, but you always need to look at the product you're going to be using to control pests and read all of those instructions very carefully. It may mention things that perhaps you need to wear a dust mask over your face because of inhalation hazards and things like that. So even because something is organic doesn't mean it's without risk. So always make sure to read those instructions.
Yeah, be very, very cautious. And let's talk to Pat in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Pat.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because I'm a native plant enthusiast and been part of a group in McHenry County. But a book that we often turn to is Plants of the Chicago Region, originally by Swink and Wilhelm, but more recently Gerald Wilhelm teamed up with a woman whose last name starts with an R, and because I'm not at home, I can't go and look at what her last name is, so I regret that. But in that book, she's the one who put together all of the faunal associates of the native plant in the Chicago region. It's quite a large book. It weighs 9 pounds, but it was recently published a year or 2 years ago. So this is like, I'm not even sure if it's considered second edition or a whole separate edition of Plants of the Chicago Region, which the Chicago Region goes from Indiana in couple of counties in Indiana up into Wisconsin.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that suggestion, Pat. Have you heard of that one, PJ?
So come to think of it, I have heard of that book. Mm-hmm. So I had mentioned a few that I've got on my bookshelf. That's probably another good one. There's probably a lot of other really good books out there once you do some digging into that.
9 pounds is a lot.
That is a big one.
Okay. And real quick before we break, we did get a question from Dan. He couldn't stay on the line, but he's wondering, what makes the black-faced or black baldy hornet sting so much more painful than the others?
Well, it's probably differences in the components in their venom. I mean, we've got a wide range of different wasps and yellow jackets and bees, and essentially the chemical components and mixtures in their venom is going to be slightly different from species to species.
What about the actual stinger itself? Does that make a difference?
Probably not. Our other yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets, their actual physical structure that they sting with is going to be very similar anatomically. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's probably differences in that venom in terms of how you react in pain.
Sure. And everybody's a little different, I'm assuming.
Yep.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with PJ Leach, and he's, of course, one of our favorite entomologists. And we'll be back to take more of your insect questions after we take this look at the news. So stay with us. Well, it's Bug Day. Do you have a question or comment about insects? We'd like to hear from you. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. PJ Leach is back with us. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab and holds degree in biological sciences. Why do I always get that wrong? And entomology from the University of Wisconsin. Have you seen an unusual bug? What questions do you have for PJ? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. And you can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. First, PJ, we did have a number of people that called and would like you to repeat the name of the book that you suggested earlier.
Yes. So I mentioned a couple of books, actually, and I couldn't recall the name of the author, so I pulled it up during the break. But the author's name is John Eastman, Eastman, and the books are illustrated by Amelia Hansen. And the books that I've got, there's three of them, The Book of Forest and Thicket, The Book of Swamp and Bog, and The Book of Field and Roadside, all by the same author, again, John Eastman, illustrated by Amelia Hansen, and it basically lists list of plants for those habitats, and then it says all the creatures associated with it. So really some useful books and easy reading, too.
Definitely. Good to know. Thanks for telling us that again. And we did have an email, too. Marilyn emailed a picture of a little blackish bug, but you identified it right away. PJ, what's it called?
Yeah, so this is a slender blackish insect called the mast hunter bug. And what's interesting about this one, it can be somewhat common. It occurs indoors. It's a predator. It is from our assassin bug group. But very recently, just in the last couple of weeks, I've had a lot of reports of these. And often when I get reports, folks will call or email thinking they have found an insect called a kissing bug, which can be associated. It can carry certain diseases like Chagas disease. We don't have kissing bugs in Wisconsin. We've just never found them here. You have to go to very bottom part of Illinois on south, and really Central America, South America, you know, Southern Texas is prime kind of kissing bug territory. So we don't have them up here, but this is a lookalike.
Okay.
So I am actually working on a post for the blog on my website that'll probably go up next week with a good side-by-side of this mast hunter bug
excellent. And
a kissing bug, so you can tell them apart really easily.
Yeah. And your website is?
Probably the easiest way to find that, if you do a Google search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. would be a great way to find it.
And that's how I usually find you. It's just easier that way. And I have a link on the program notes, so you can go to WPR.org/Larry and see today's post, and you can link it right there. And one more from email. Alice in Boaz emailed wondering why they haven't seen any bees in their locust trees for 2 years. Their sound used to be deafening. Are they all gone, or perhaps a casualty of pesticides?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I would say in general this year, I mean, I'm seeing plenty of bees and other pollinators out there. It did seem to be a bit quieter year, though, especially during the spring. And I think because it was cool and rainy, and cool, rainy weather is poor conditions for pollinators to go out and forage. They want to be out there when it's sun, the flowers are nice and open, lots of nectar, that sort of thing. So bees, butterflies, they just aren't very active during rainy periods, which we had earlier this year. Now that the weather's a little bit warmer, you know, there might be a couple potential explanations. It might have just been some residual impact from the rainy spring. If juvenile stages were developing then and didn't do very well, maybe there is some mortality from that. I mean, my overall impression on insect populations is there can be quite a bit of variation from year to year. We do hear about bees and pollinators and other insects in declines. And the tough thing with that is to actually pick out a declining trend. You need a long-term data set. You need to have been observing and collecting them for really years and decades to be able to tell, is it actually declining or is it just noise in the signal, so to speak? But I have had some similar reports again. Pollinators not quite seeing as many this year as in previous years. Is that pesticides? Is it other causes? Can't really tell at this point. We do have concerns with certain types of pesticides, for example. A big factor perhaps is land use changes just in the state and really across the country and the entire world due to urbanization and things like that and monoculture crops. We've gotten rid of a lot of natural habitat. You know, we've left some pockets here and there, parks and green spaces, but it's fragmented and isolated. We know a lot of creatures do better if they had a big contiguous patch of habitat. So that's probably a big factor as well. There are diseases and parasites and invasive species competing with them, perhaps. So there's really a lot of different factors in terms of what could potentially be going on.
Okay. And thanks for sending that email, Alice. We appreciate that. Let's go back to the phones, and we have Chris in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Last spring, about a year ago, I had a bit of a cold and I blew my nose. And when I looked down, there was a bug about not quite a half inch in length, about the circumference of a piece of lead in a pencil. And it had brown, black, and yellow stripes on it with a bright cherry red head. And on the other end was kind of a hair, some hair kind of shaped like a rooster's tail. I kind of wondered what that was.
Okay. Well, that's got me scratching my head a bit. I mean, when you think of humans and insects that live on us, I can only think of a few things. That'd be things like head lice and, you know, a few other things out there. I can't think of anything that matches your description. So I would really wonder, was it something that might have been crawling on a tissue or something like that and it was noticed afterwards? Because that just doesn't quite make sense for insects that I would think of being associated with humans.
Okay. So sorry about that, Chris, but hopefully that won't happen again. next, we have Tom in Cedarburg. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I have a question about deer flies. They're very bad this year out by me. And I'm wondering, I'd heard that wasps and hornets and stuff will go after them. I had seen a smaller bug, bigger than a deer fly, but a real thin bug that had like a probe that went, that was actually sticking into the deer fly, and they kind of flew together. So I don't know if that other bug that was on top of the deer fly was killing it or just taking something from it. I don't know, but if there is something that I can maybe put out more wasps or something like that to go after these wretched deer flies.
Yeah.
When I think of deer flies, there are, you know, undoubtedly going to be some generalist insect predators that'll probably feed on them if they can catch them. Some of the wasps, like yellow jackets and perhaps paper wasps, if they could catch them or, you know, found one that was wounded or managed to snatch it, they could certainly feed on it. There are some other predatory flies, robber flies, for example, maybe dragonflies, things like that. Based on your description, I wonder if you might have encountered a type of assassin bug. And we just had that picture we talked about of the mast hunter bug. The assassin bug family is a diverse family. We've got dozens of species in our area. And they have a tube-like or beak-like mouth part, kind of like a mosquito. So they're essentially fluid feeders. They will stick their tube-like mouth part into their prey and then essentially liquefy it and suck the nutrients out that way. So I'm guessing you might have bumped into an assassin bug that was having that deer fly as a snack.
Mm-hmm. Wow, interesting. Thanks, Tom. Nathan, let's go to you. He's in Honey Creek. Hi, Nathan.
Hi. Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been listening to the show since it started, and very interesting, and you know, I appreciate what you guys are doing today. I wanted to go back a little earlier. You were discussing doing a bug count and setting up lights for moths. And I was wondering what kind of setup I could do. I mean, they're going to flutter around the light. How would I get them to land and be able to check them out?
Yeah.
I do have a metal halide light, and I know I can get a black light, and I just think that would be really interesting to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we know a lot of insects come to light, so you're not just going to get moths. You'll get a wide range of things, but often the light surveying is a great way to in particular spot moths in addition to other things. That could be as simple as going out and looking at what's at your back deck light. That's what I tend to do in the evening when I let the dogs out at home. But we often use black light traps. Insects see more towards the blue or purplish or UV end of the spectrum compared to humans, and they don't see as much of the red. So their vision spectrum has shifted a little bit. So that's why we use the black light traps. The mercury vapor lights also put out some wavelengths towards the UV end of the spectrum. And so that can be a little bit more attractive. But any light will probably attract some insects. If you have a black light that you can put out, could just be a black light, you know, party bulb from the hardware store, something like that. That will probably help. There are some entomology supply companies that sell traps and setups specifically for nighttime insect surveying, so they may have higher wattage bulbs and that sort of thing. If you're interested in something like that, probably the best company I can think of is called BioQuip. BioQuip. They're based out of San Diego area, and that's kind of the biggest entomology supply company in the country. So they've got all kinds of traps. In general, if you want to do it, it would go something like this. You'd put your light trap out or hang your light bulb. And often folks that are serving moths, they will hang up like a white bed sheet and maybe put the light behind it. That way you end up having this big rectangular screen. Things will fly in and land on that. You know, some insects may fly in and kind of pass by and leave again, and you can't do much about those. But in a lot of cases, they may land on that sheet, and they may be there for a short period. You could check them out, and then they're gone. Sometimes, though, insects will sit there, and if their flight muscles cool down, then they can literally sit there for hours sometimes. They may still be there the next morning, even long after the light's been off. So that's often a great way. If you don't have a way to string up a light sheet, if you have a light-colored garage or other building and you could put the light up on the side of that, that can work very well in addition.
Great. Have fun, Nathan. That sounds like a good time. Let's see. Paul in Burlington is next. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I have a question about millipedes. I have, unfortunately, from my research, I've discovered the ideal habitat, multiple flagstone retaining walls with crushed gravel, and they've become worse over the years, and now I just had to hire somebody to come and spray because it's literally at invasion level. But I had called into a different show, and there was an entomologist that was theorizing that perhaps these millipedes are simply on the move and my house is in the way, and that they could return to normal levels, whatever that is, after a while. But I'm just wondering if there's anything I can do, especially on a more natural pesticide level, to deal with them, or should I go the other route and embrace them and start making little cardboard homes and just welcoming them?
Thanks, Paul.
Well, to comment on what you heard from the other entomologists, that definitely can be true. So millipedes, under the right conditions, they can occur in large numbers and they wander. It can be surprisingly long distances. I mean, they may be able to cover the length of a football field or so. maybe more than that in a given night. So they're really traveling sometimes some long distances. I often see lots of reports of this type of activity in about the month of June, first part of July. I mean, this year in terms of weather patterns are being a little bit behind long-term average. So we're spot on for that time of the year. Eventually, I would expect things to kind of quiet down on their own. We get this period of activity. Things are out. They're moving around. Eventually, they go where they want to go, and things tend to quiet down. Sometimes I see a little bit of activity again in the fall, but that's a very common pattern that we see. In terms of dealing with them, and we did have another call earlier in the show, millipedes can be very frustrating. Sometimes if you know right where the source is, we may be able to use a lawn-type insecticide right in that area, the thought being we could kill them there before they wander elsewhere. In other cases, though, it's hard to pinpoint where they're coming from. In a case like that, we're probably not going to be able to get rid of all of them, but what you can at least do is some things to help prevent them from getting in your house. So we discussed earlier in the show about physical exclusion. That would be using caulk, expanding insulation foam, better weather stripping, prevent them from getting into your house at least and keep them outside. Sometimes folks will also do a barrier type treatment along the bottom of their foundation and maybe out a little bit on like a sidewalk. The thought is if you kill the millipedes there before they get in your house, you know, that might be good enough. In the grand scheme of things, they're not going to hurt anything. If they get in your house, they're not going to be able to survive. It's just too dry for them. So they're just a nuisance. Again, mm-hmm. they're not going to hurt anything. But sometimes you just have to kind of wait for things to run their course and millipede activity to die down on its own.
And Paul, if you make those little cardboard houses, please send a picture so we can see. Next up, we've got Jay, and he's in Holman. Hi, Jay.
Oh, I'm seeing insect, a little worm that's yellow with a black face, and it's in a web, and it's not eastern tent caterpillar, and it's not fall webworm, but it's making a big ratty, a little rattier looking than either of those web on box elder.
On box elder. Okay. I mean, given the time of the year, I have seen some cases of fall webworm out there, and the appearance of fall webworm can vary. Sometimes they are almost pure white. Sometimes they are a bit darker in color. I can't think of it off the top of my head. I have bumped into one situation before with box elder. There's a weird type of caterpillar. I think it's from the family Tortricidae, and I can't think of the common name for it. But I have seen it go to box elder trees, actually a row of three or four box elder trees, and basically eat the entire thing and make a web over multiple trees.
Wow.
I've only seen that once in my career. This was a few years ago. So there is that one other weird species out there. In that case, it was present one year and gone the next, as far as I know. So it tends to be a rare, uncommon species, pops up. They do make very noticeable silken webbing. But if the tree is in good health, it probably just bounces back fine the
okay.
following season.
Is this another one of those where if Jay could get a picture and send it to you, you could
definitely
identify
yeah, pictures
it.
Would okay. be really helpful in mm-hmm. a case like this.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so Jay, you can take a picture and you can send it to PJ at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab and just Google that. Let's go to Deborah in Brown Deer. Hi, Deborah.
Hello. I live about a block north of Brown Deer Park in Brown Deer, Wisconsin, and we have a lot of spruce trees and many trees that I've fallen in love with around this community are dying. And about a month ago, I heard this noise coming from our 40-foot spruce that's now dead. And I Googled it, and it ended up being a bark beetle. And I think there's not a lot of awareness. I mean, our neighbors just had one taken down, and the people in back of us had one taken down. And I think it's just spreading. The white pines seem resistant to it, but wondered if you could shed some light on bark beetles.
Sure. So given the description of the situation, and you very likely could have bark beetles present, with the noise, though, there is a common insect called the white-spotted pine sawyer, and as they chew inside the tree, you can hear them quite noticeably. Sounds kind of like a creaky door almost.
Interesting.
I was up north back in June, and I could hear one in a tree from about 40 feet away.
Oh, my.
So it can be
wow.
fairly loud and noticeable mm-hmm. if it's quiet outside. With both those insects, though, and these bark beetles, Both of those types of beetles can be very common in conifers that are dying, declining, typically for another reason, though. So my overall suspicion in a case like this, when I hear of dying, declining conifers, that makes me wonder about plant diseases. In the last several years, it's been very, very rainy. So if you have a spruce tree or a pine that comes down with a foliar needle disease and it's being stressed for that, all of a sudden the tree is weakened, it's compromised, then these secondary opportunistic insects get in. And then it's kind of a downhill slope from there. So even though there's probably insects in these trees, it sounds like, I actually wonder if there was another thing that started the decline, and then these insects simply moved into a weakened, dying tree at that point.
Okay. Thank you for that question, Deborah. Let's go to Andy in Mount Horeb. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I was fishing on Lake Mendota this morning, and I had a damselfly land on my finger, and it was a color that I've never seen before. It was a pale yellow. I mean, normally they're blue, and I've never seen that color before.
I mean, when it comes to dragonflies and damselflies, we've got well over 100 different species in the state. So there's a lot of variation between the species. I'm not sure off the top of my head if this is true for damselflies, but I know with certain dragonflies, for example, when the adult first emerges, it may be a color such as yellowish, and then over time, the color changes to a different form. There are some dragonflies that start out kind of yellowish, and by the time they've really dried out and kind of fully matured, they're reddish color. So I wonder if that might be a possibility. Also, if you had found an insect that just very recently molted, their new exoskeleton is very pale because it hasn't gone through this hardening tanning process yet. And over the course of several hours, that different color, mature color form will come on. So I wonder if that's a possibility in this case, or it might just be a different species that might have a yellow form to it.
Sure. And if you're interested in dragon or damselflies, Andy, we're going to be speaking to an author of a book that is all about damsel and dragonflies. And I think it might be next weekend or next Wednesday or the Wednesday after. So keep listening, and you'll learn even more about those really neat insects. We did get a picture, PJ, from Sarah, and she's got a picture of a leaf, and she says these beetle-type bugs are making lace of her plants. Do you know what they are and how she can dissuade them from eating there?
Yes. So this is, at this time of the year, probably public enemy number one of the insect world. These are Japanese beetles.
Sure.
And they pop out usually late June, early July, and they're going to be active into about early September. You might see some stragglers into October, but it's basically the months of July and August we see peak pressure. They're an invasive species originally from East Asia. They've been in the country over 100 years, and they feed on a very, very wide range of plants, which is why they're such a good invasive species, is they have almost unlimited food. So they go to plants. They tend to nibble around the tough veins, and they eat these little holes in the leaves. We call that skeletonization. So in the picture that was sent in, this is classic Japanese beetle damage. In terms of what you can do about it, depends on the plant. We do have some sprays, including organic options. You might be able to cover the plant with mesh screening to keep them off, but you kind of have to put up the fight for about 2 months or so.
For 2 months. And they don't necessarily come back again next year in full force, right? They kind of
Their numbers vary from year to year. You'll probably always see some every summer once they get in your area, but some years are high populations, others low.
Okay. Well, PJ, thank you once again for all the information that you've provided for us. Always good to see you. We've been talking with PJ Leach. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he'll be back with us on November 20th. On the show tomorrow, we'll talk about the B-17 airplane and 40 years of American Players Theater. Hope you can join us starting at 11 o'clock. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network.